WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Susie Ahn, in for Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. It's Friday, and that means it's time for our weekly news recap, where we break down the biggest local and state stories of the week. Stories like these.
Big news from the White Sox.
Longtime owner Jerry Reinsdorf has an agreement in place to transition ownership, but it won't be happening anytime soon.
Our long regional nightmare is over. CHSN is coming to Comcast.
A stunning announcement. The Chicago Fire is moving to the 78,
which sits in a vacant plot in South Loop.
The soccer team's planning to build a new stadium in the new neighborhood, and they say they can get it all done by 2028.
The journalists who joined us to slice and dice the news this time around form a kind of WBEZ and former WBEZ super panel. We had midday anchor extraordinaire Lisa Labez, Axios Chicago reporter and former WBEZ executive producer and host Justin Kaufman, and rounding out the panel, Natalie Moore, senior lecturer and director of audio journalism programming at Northwestern University. Before that, of course, Natalie was a longtime reporter and editor here at the station. It was so good to see everyone, and it truly felt like old times. But before we started on the news, we thought it would be fun to check and see if anyone wanted to take a guess how long, collectively, the four of us have worked or did work at WBEZ. Lisa went first.
Consecutive, you know, or like, you know, all together, like...
Yeah, total. Maybe not counting intern days, but...
70 years.
Yeah, I was going to say 430 years.
I'm going to say 80.
Ooh, Natalie, you are very close.
Our
Reset's executive producer totaled it all up, and we collectively are at 82
wow.
years and
82.
3 months.
Nice.
That's pretty amazing. A true testament to
Where's
you.
Where's our Medicare?
Well, jury's still out on that one.
Okay.
But anyway.
I was like, Medicare.
Wow, yeah. So they've changed things here at public radio.
Okay, so... Love hearing all the years that we bring here to WBEZ. So let's get into the news. We'll of course get to the big news of the week, the ICE detention in Chicago. But first, let's talk a little bit about sports business news in Chicago. We've got a possible new stadium planned. Not the Bears this time. Justin.
Go down the list, Susie. Not the Bears, not the White Sox, not the Red Stars.
Who could it be?
But it's the Chicago Fire. Joe Mansueto, the billionaire here in Chicago, who also owns the Wrigley Building. Did you know that?
I did not.
Yeah, he owns the Wrigley
fun
Building.
Fact.
Yeah, isn't that a fun fact? He and the Chicago Fire have been looking for a stadium. They moved to Soldier Field in 2020 after leaving Bridgeview and the SeatGeek Stadium out there. And decided that they want to get into the stadium derby here in Chicago, and he wants to put up to over $600 million to do a privately funded stadium in the 78, which is the mega development down in the South Loop along the river. This is the mega development that at one point was going to be the Chicago Casino. At one point, it was going to be a mega neighborhood. Then it was going to be a White Sox stadium, a Discovery Center, like an institute for science. And now it's going to be a Chicago Fire soccer stadium. There's a lot of questions that still haven't been answered.
Yeah.
That it comes down to, you know, when we were talking about the White Sox, they were talking about all sorts of money that the state was going to have to pony up to not only finance the stadium, but finance the infrastructure around that area. If you're familiar with the area along the 78, it's very dense. There's a lot of densely populated areas around there. And so parking is an issue. Roads are an issue. So there still will be infrastructure needs, but that will be on the 78 side, not necessarily the Chicago Fire. So it's a big move for the Fire to move down there. And it might spell the end of of the dreams of Jerry Reinsdorf of bringing the White Sox stadium to the same location. There has been some hints that they could do both, that it could be like if you're in Philadelphia, for instance, you have stadiums that are all grouped together. So you'll have the baseball and football are kind of all in the same area. And so there could be, but we're talking about a pretty specifically small plot of land. I think it's 62 acres that are actually on the 78 there. So I don't know how you're going to get all these stadiums add the Bears. Let's put them all in. Right. But the idea being that right now the Chicago Fire and Joe Mansueto, because of the private money, is in the lead to be able to build a stadium in that area.
Yeah. But is it a little disingenuous to say that there's, yes, he's privately funding it, but it's still a public,
right?
Like the infrastructure, like you said, and the roads, like all of that, the city, somebody, taxpayers are going to have to pick that up.
Yeah,
so the framing of it is... really not.
Well, and but the hard part is like most of the, like you talk about the Bears or the White Sox, when they start talking about public money from downstate, everyone thinks it's about, well, they're going to build a stadium. That's not necessarily the case. What they're looking for, the name of the game in sports and stadium building is the entertainment district that goes around it.
Yeah, like so, what the Cubs did.
Right.
Absolutely, what the
Cubs did. Ricketts bought up all those buildings, and now it's a district, not just the stadium. Mm-hmm. The White Sox want that. So they want to be able to build hotels and bars. The Bears want that. That's why they're trying to get in Arlington
Heights. How many stadiums do you need? Do you need a specific stadium for each sport? Can't we, like,
The problem is Wrigley Field is 30, 40,000 seats, and it's one of the smaller ones in baseball. In football, for instance, Soldier Field is 60,000 seats, where they're building 110, 120,000 for other major market NFL teams. So, yes, the issue is it's about size and you know, how much money these guys can make off it. For the Sky, I think, or not for the Sky, for the Fire, it's 22,000 seats is what they're looking for.
But the appetite is really different. 20 years ago, you could get the public to buy in, like, oh, here are the benefits. Here's this. People don't want their taxpayer money. They're like, Bears, bye, go to Arlington Heights. Or, you know, it's when you have other sagging infrastructure like bridges and roads, people don't want a stadium. And I know that it's not apples to apples to say, okay, well, this is a billionaire owner. Let them just foot it all. But that's the way the public is perceiving it, is that these franchises have a lot of money. Let them do it on their own. There are all these other pressing issues. The state consistently is like, we're not interested.
You sound like a certain governor in Illinois. I forgot his name, but a certain governor says the same thing Natalie Moore says. Somebody advising on that. But yeah, but Governor
Pritzker.
This is
what Pritzker, I hear from the people.
Governor Pritzker says that. He throws cold water on the Bears and the White Sox because it's like, right now, we got a lot of issues.
If the state isn't interested, how will this get done? I mean, they're consistently, like you said, throwing cold water, but it's like, no,
The amount of money that would be needed to fix the infrastructure for the 78 is much lower than, say, the money that would be needed to build a stadium. And so there is some to say, okay, well, that money can be financed and done in different ways. So it's not that big of a deal to build out Clark Street or build out these parking structures at the 78 for the Chicago Fire Stadium. But you're absolutely right. There is no appetite right now. And you have a governor in Illinois who is like, you know what? I could, in good conscience, could not be giving money to sports stadiums when we have so many emergency situations when it comes down to what our funding is or what our money is going to be
funding. Right. Well, the 78 is supposed to be one of several so-called mega developments in Chicago that boosters say could transform the city. I mean, we've got, you know, Lincoln Yards between Lincoln Park and Bucktown. They're both billed as these...
which is kind of stalled, right?
Right. Yeah. It's like this sort of like city within a city, you know, all this like mixed residential towers, venues, retail space, and things like that. I mean, pros and cons of these mega developments. Let's say we get the financing for it. Is this going to, are we going to get the financial gain if these are to actually be developed?
Well, why not create something really new? Like, we know what Chicago's problems are around segregation, around equity. And so instead of saying, let's, you know, create another figuratively gated community with these high-end elements, let's, like, what would a utopian neighborhood look like? Just start, like, have a different kind of vision to get buy-in and not just do the basic set-asides for affordable housing. I mean, affordable housing in the city is concentrated in certain areas, and it's not. And if you want vibrant communities, you should have all different kinds of people, all different kinds of entertainment,
You know, what are the construction opportunities? I think that these things could be sold if they weren't done as is, the way, you know, history has shown in this.
But these aren't city planners. You know, these are developers, and developers.
But they,
at a certain
but
point,
they have to get. But they have to get approval from the planning commission. And so, why not come to the table and say, we want to do things differently?
And I would argue that sports, as a, you know, the focus of these developments, is not necessarily inclusive of everybody, because you've got high ticket prices. You've got, you know, people who can't get there. People, you know, it's just not for everybody.
Yeah, are you going to go to the restaurant that's over by the soccer stadium just to go eat and not see the game?
And a $12 beer? I don't know.
I think the intrigue, too, is that the soccer stadiums are always attached to these developments, or sports stadiums have been. You've seen this. And the Lincoln Yards, you mentioned, the original plan was to put a soccer stadium at Lincoln Yards. Yeah. And the alderman there said that is not feasible. There's not infrastructure. They actually yanked that out before it got approval. Hmm. So it's interesting that the same similar, you know, mega development on the south side is now going to accept the soccer stadium that Lincoln Yards got, you know, that it got taken away. I think at the end of the day, it's about how you want a city to look, especially a city that used to be have a lot of manufacturing infrastructure. And you think about these near-collar neighborhoods to downtown, and whether you're talking about the south side with all the rail yards there, that's where the 78's at along the river, or the north side, which is a lot of Finkel Steel and places like that. So the question becomes, how do you rebuild a city or transform a city that is land that's either decrepit, decaying, or just empty in this point? And I think that there's still a give and take about how much the public is on the hook to make that happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to switch over to some different sports news. The White Sox could get a new owner. I mean, there's a very long timeline on this one.
Justin Wilson. This is my favorite story of the week. So Jerry Reinsdorf, who is the owner, you could say, you know, notorious. Let me put it that way. Good or bad, notorious. He's owned the White Sox. Right now, the White Sox fan base is very upset with the White Sox because they're in this long rebuild. They aren't putting a product on the field that's worth watching. He's in the market for a new stadium. There's been rumors before that he's like, I'm going to move. If you don't give me the money, I'm going to move to Nashville. There's been clamoring for him to sell the team. He came out yesterday with an agreement that said that he will sell controlling interest to Justin Ishbia. Justin is one of the Ishbia brothers who own the Phoenix Suns. They're kind of the new, they're the Tom Ricketts of 10 years ago. You know, like, they're the newer, they're going to bring fresh blood. They're doing things in Phoenix that the Arizona fans love. So anyway, the fine print here is that he's going to give option to the controlling interest in 2029. It said it can happen between 2029 and 2033, and then it is guaranteed to happen in some case by 2034. Jerry Reinsdorf is 89 years old. And so if you think about that time lane over a decade, he has to sell the team. He's you know, he said to his fan base, I hear you. I'm going to sell the team when I'm 100 years old. That's essentially what he's saying here, and that I think is where the fan, that's why you scratch your head, because
I'm ready,
you're like,
then.
Yes, it's a great, I mean, yes, it's progress, and Ishbia is a minority investor right now in the White Sox, so he's part of the family anyway. But the point being that this timeline has fans scratching their heads, saying this isn't going to happen tomorrow. You're not going to see a turnaround in management.
Right.
You're talking about a possible change in controlling interest in 5 to 6 years.
Natalie, Lisa, thoughts on this this change in ownership years down the line?
You know, we had a bunch of middle schoolers in here, and I can't remember what school they handed me their school newspaper, and there was an opinion column about how horrible Jerry Reinsdorf is from middle schoolers, and I thought they have opinions.
Yeah.
You know, so the opinion said you can't build a new stadium unless you have a team that's worth watching, basically. So
see, sports can bring people together.
There you go.
It can. I agree with the middle schoolers.
Think about the Reinsdorf's just impact on Chicago. The 90s Bulls, of course, but he's also been at the forefront of a lot of charities. He's also been someone who has owned these establishments and these franchises for so many years. His family's a big name in Chicago. He has had control of things, like sports teams bring people together, but he's had control of these two franchises. So it does mark a moment in which you may see a transition.
That's right. Well, before we head to a break, one more sports business story.
Just today, right?
The Sox, yep. Bulls, Blackhawks are coming to Comcast.
This is such a strange story, and I'll do it quick. The CHSN, the Chicago Sports Network, took over. Reinsdorf and Wirtz families decided they wanted to run their own regional sports network. So you used to watch the White Sox on NBC Sports. They changed it to their own, but they couldn't get a deal with Comcast. So for the first year, that means the Blackhawks, the Bulls, and the White Sox have not been on cable. They've only been on DirecTV or streaming services.
Yeah, I had to buy an antenna.
Right, or over the they love to tell you, go buy an antenna, it's easy. But a report came out and said that the Blackhawks lost 78% of their viewers last year.
Yeah.
Because Comcast is a prevailing cable provider here in Chicago. That's the way it is. So today they are back on Channel 200 on Chicago Sports Network. The catch, though, is that you're going to have to pay more. It's at the ultimate tier to be able to get games for Bulls, Blackhawks, and White Sox. What a moment to think about. The Cubs are on marquee. The only team that's free over the air now will be the Bears. But if you think about it, think about WGN-TV. For so many decades, we got to see sports free on an afternoon or a game. That day is gone in Chicago.
Yeah, so not exactly a win for fans.
No.
Big news of the week, something that happened earlier this week in the South Loop. ICE agents detained at least 10 immigrants at a South Loop facility. Chaos ensued as ICE agents clashed with protesters and elected officials who were there at the scene. Natalie, what was your reaction to that?
So the people who went down to this building on 22nd in Michigan had gotten a text like, you have to come down right now. And then they were, you know, falsely lured, ambushed. You know, I was thinking about the different, you know, immigration moves, detainments that are happening all over the country, how people. So on one hand, you had people coming together to form a chain, the activists, you know, activated very quickly, elected officials, you know, Alders came down. But it also made me think about Tom Homan, the so-called border czar, who, they did come into Chicago, and they weren't as successful as they wanted to be, mm-hmm. with detaining. And he said, you know, Chicago was hard. Yeah. Like, they are organized, they're protecting people. And so this sneak move to me felt like, all right, we're trying to get back at you, because we weren't able to. And it's not as if this hasn't had a chilling effect. Like, think about the Cinco de Mayo celebrations that didn't happen, or, you know, people being afraid to send their children to school, being afraid to shop in Little Village. So, you know, they have had the effect of scaring people. But at the same time, the mutual aid and compassion and community that also comes out of a place like Chicago has really irritated their souls.
Yeah.
And I saw this as a direct response to what they weren't able to do before.
Yeah, and I mean, these text messages too, I mean, it's got folks in the immigrant community like just questioning what they should do. If they get these text messages, you comply or you risk being on the hook for something else for not complying. We talked to three Chicago City Council members on Reset yesterday who were there as the immigration detentions unfolded. And I think it's fair to say that they were pretty shaken by the experience. Lisa, you were listening in on that conversation.
Yeah.
What did you take away from Alders Rodriguez Sanchez, Cincho Lopez, and Quezada, what they had to say about it?
You know, I think it was Cincho Lopez that he was very... It was very upsetting, you know, it was very upsetting, but they didn't want to be deterred from their focus and their mission and trying to help. But it's very clear that they're going to have to just keep regrouping continually and figuring out their next moves. It's not a one and done kind of a thing. They're just going to have to keep at it, you know, and keep on it. And just trying to get their message out, I think, is difficult. You know, and what it is they need to do and how they need to communicate with people who, you know, anybody who could possibly be detained in any way, they need to know, and they need to know there's help.
I mean, with the videos that were out there, it was a very chaotic scene. And even in one of those, I saw a clip of Alderman Quezada getting pushed mm-hmm. down. And I think it concerns many folks to see that if an elected official can kind of get caught up and pushed down by that, you know, what's that mean for the safety in our city when you know, people might be trying to exercise their First Amendment rights?
And also the role of the Chicago Police Department, which isn't supposed to help ICE officials, federal agents, but they were called there. But they said they were responding to a call, but were they helping? It to me, it seems unclear about their role. And if there's, you know, in other cities, police are helping.
Right. Yeah.
And is this a turn for Chicago?
It is. I mean, the one where I kind of sum up, you know, what you said, Natalie, is performative in a way that the time lapse is interesting in this case, where people came at a certain point. It took a couple hours. The crowd sort of amassed outside before people were taken from the office into the van. So the idea of this being some sort of secret detention or something they wanted to do, you know, like on the sly, almost it kind of goes against that thought, because they spent a lot of time waiting for almost like a crowd to amass. And the Resurrection Project, mm-hmm. an advocacy group here, says that the immigration enforcement officials had a cameraman that was there that was taking photos. So there was something that was like they wanted to document this as well. And I think at the end of the day, that's really, you kind of got at the idea, and having the Alder people on yesterday, is this idea of who's accountable, mm-hmm. and who can you talk to about these things? If you're an Alder in Chicago and you want to be able to talk to a police officer, you can do that. In the case of the of ICE agents and the officials, they're not giving any information. You do not exist if you're an Alder. And so I think there's some questions there about what is the accountability, what is the sort of sharing of information, or at least understanding a little bit more. ICE came out and you know, Homeland Security gave a statement that said there was a judge gave a statement of final order of removal. But that's the kind of stuff that's after the fact. I mean, why can't that be told to
Alder Cisco?
Yeah,
right.
I think at a certain point that's what's the question here is what kind of games are being played. And these are pretty, you know, this is a substantial issue, not just for the people who are involved, who are getting deported, or families who are being changed forever, but also just about the instability of our institutions in Chicago, meaning we need to know our elected officials, our police, other people need to know what the federal government's doing, and they need to go back and forth. Even if they're not supposed to cooperate, there should be an exchange of information.
But right. this is kind of textbook for what the federal government has been doing with these kind of detentions in many instances, where they'll, you know, load up a plane or they'll detain people, and, you know, off goes the plane, and then comes the order, you know, and then they have to backtrack. When did the judge's order come down? You know, you got to bring that plane back, you know. So it's kind of disingenuous for, you know, for these detentions to happen, and then, oh, well, here's our proof.
Right. Yeah, and also I think from a Chicagoan standpoint too, you know, 22nd in Michigan and a Wednesday afternoon, that's a very busy intersection. Mm-hmm. It's also an area that, you know, you're having these clashes with police and protesters and chaos and people getting pushed to the ground. That is something that is going to get the attention of all of the city, even if you have skin in the game when it comes to immigration or not. That's the kind of stuff that I think at the end of the day, Chicagoans want to know what's going on and why that kind of thing is happening. And I know that the Latino Caucus at the city council is calling for hearings, and so we might get to the bottom of it. I think it's very interesting to see the mayor of Chicago come out and really really admonish the ICE and mm-hmm. to say essentially that it was kidnapping. This is not the end of this issue, and I think you're going to see more of it as more of these statements, especially if the president gets involved, on Truth Social or Twitter, this will be inflamed.
Yeah, and I will say that you mentioned that ICE did have a statement. They said that people were detained and that they had, quote, executable final orders of removal by an immigration judge and had not complied with that order. CPD also came out with a statement that they had been called to the location earlier, and that, quote, CPD was on site to ensure the safety of all involved, including those exercising their First Amendment rights. Justin, you had mentioned the emergency hearing. You know, what can city lawmakers do, or even the mayor do, to prevent the federal government from detaining Chicagoans here without legal status?
I don't think anything. I don't think that. I mean, they'll do what they can to disrupt it, but I think if there are statutory or in a sanctuary laws on the books, it's almost designed that way to be like the federal government does their thing, we do our thing. So there's not really much they can do. I think this hearing, which is a very small little kind of twist on it, is really to look at how the Chicago police worked when it came to this demonstration, event, action, whatever you want to call it. And that's what they're going to do, is to see, to get to Natalie's point about, were they there, were they called to control the crowd? Were they there to assist ICE? What was their role in letting this all kind of play out? That's, I think, where you're going to see more about that and what we can control in Chicago. But from the federal government, I'm not sure there is much that the city of Chicago and any of the and the alders that were there can do about what the city's. Now, the question I have, and this is such a small little thing, but one of the things that led to the confusion was that the alders had no idea who these agents were. And this is something you've heard from communities. And when you see the video, you understand they are not
mask wearing.
They're wearing masks, which I understand there's a lot of conflict, but they're also kind of wearing different colored hoodies. They don't have badges. They don't say police in certain points. So there really is this kind of, there was this shot from one of the news, 10 o'clock news, where you saw them kind of marching towards the people. And you're like, I would not be able to say those were police. They look a little disheveled, like they're not in uniform the way that we have understood how police are to be uniformed.
Yeah.
And the same with federal police or state police or whatever. So that also is adding to the frustration and I think the confusion to be like, are you a deputized? Sitchko Lopez made that point right away about, I can't tell if this is a mercenary, someone from the Proud Boys, if this is someone who's actually a federal agent. They won't say.
Yeah.
And so that is where I think there is a lot of confusion, because when you see it, you're like, that does not look like an officer.
Yeah,
like that's why it looks like kidnapping.
Right.
Yeah. I mean,
right,
we've seen videos around the country of it's the same kind of look. And this is intentional. Mm-hmm. They know that they're cameras. They want to make people afraid. They want them to look like mercenaries, because they're okay with being called kidnappers, or, you know, the whole, I don't know, the kidnap. And I don't mean the actual kidnappers, but the so-called border czars and the Trump administration, like they are okay with this. And then to juxtapose that with, they don't want people wearing masks.
Mm. Yeah.
And then they're wearing masks.
Right, for health reasons.
Yeah, the hypocrisy is
tough. You can't wear masks.
Yeah.
And but here, masks are totally fine.
And I will say,
fine.
For those who are out there, I guess we'll call them agents, some were wearing HSI vests, which is Homeland Security Investigations, which maybe that's not something that you would think in this situation.
Right.
Maybe you'd expect to see ICE or police or something like that. So definitely a lot of confusion in that way. You know, Natalie, when it comes to a story like this, one about immigration and the federal government's enforcement tactics, I'm curious how you talk to your students about how to report on this, especially in these chaotic type of situations.
Yeah. I mean, one, I tell them you're not going to be covering the White House anytime soon. So let's get some skills first. But I do tell them to cover this as a local story on campus. Because, you know, these are national stories, but they come down to the state level, the county level, the local level. But also, you know, Northwestern is a target from the Trump administration. We know about international students, you know, who want to come here having their social scrubbed. There are, you know, who's getting deported, who's on campus. So I think that because they're closer to the ground, I'm saying, you should be doing a half hour radio special on WNUR about this. So, and I do have international students who have not been able to go home. They know if they leave, they may not be able to come back. So on one hand, just supporting students, you know, just from a humanity level. But then also saying, okay, what can you do to report this? Like, the stories are big, even if you aren't part of the Washington Press Corps.
Yeah, definitely. Well, along the lines of immigration, Justin Chicago is also preparing for what may come after the Supreme Court, the decision to let certain migrant protections lapse. What's the story?
Yeah,
there?
This was the Supreme Court ruling at the end of last week. The Supreme Court ruling, rulings are coming out now, but there is really essentially lapsing the sort of TPS, the
temporary
protected status, which was at the heart of the migrant surge that came to Chicago in the last 2 years. That's why it's a Chicago story. This is a national story, kind of gets passed by, but that was what, you know, the officials here and other big cities were pushing for, to get this temporary protected status so that migrants who came here seeking asylum would be able to go to work instead of just being in a shelter or being waiting for their process, which could take years and years to do. That was something that the Biden administration finally came to the aid of these mayors like Brandon Johnson or Lori Lightfoot and said, okay, we're going to do that. So Trump, essentially there was a Supreme Court ruling that the Trump administration wanted to get rid of it. They said, yes, you can get rid of it. And now what that does is it puts all the migrants who came here, who were bused here from Texas. This is what I just really blows my mind to think about. Now they're in jeopardy of essentially, quote unquote, breaking the law, and will have to and could be deported. And it comes down to this, like when we're talking about how much money, you'll see a lot of people say, oh, they're spending so much money on migrants instead of our communities here in Chicago, or we're doing this. The amount of money it will take, and you see it in the federal budget right now, is staggering for deportations and billions of dollars. And you're like, so we're going to put money on top of money to essentially go and remove the people who were bused here. We had to. It's just a quagmire. And to me, it is really important for Chicago to think about the recent history of what just happened here. There's so much debate over how it all kind of played out in 2023 and 2024 here in Chicago. And now here we are, where the Supreme Court is making rulings that essentially will pave the way to undo all the work that Chicago did in the last couple of years. And that to me is a very important, and as taxpayers and everyone else, we should take a look at that to be like, wait, you know, we were moving in a direction. I mean, I was fascinated to see that the migrant shelter system that Mayor Johnson had to fund to put in place is actually being used as a homeless shelter system now. And that's something that you think about from people like, you waste all this money on migrants. I'm like, no, not necessarily. We found a way, and Mayor Johnson ran on the idea of or having housing as a right. And he's finding ways to do that. So there are some things that came out of that are good, in the sense that there's a system of shelter that wasn't there before. But man, to think about how politics and ideology is going to undo millions of dollars that have been spent to essentially integrate and let people into our community, to say, listen, you're going to be part of our community. Let's go to work, do all this kind of stuff. It blows my mind as a Chicagoan.
In addition, boosting Chicago's population, we've seen an increase. We've seen some additions to schools. Chicago public schools have seen increased enrollment, which had been, you know, so-called under-enrolled. And I mean, as someone who takes public transportation, the Red Line, CTA, in Black neighborhoods, you know, I can see. I mean, I don't know that I don't go up to them and say, are you migrants? But these weren't integrated neighborhoods, racially integrated neighborhoods. And you see, like, they're taking their kids to school. They're riding the bus. Like, they are becoming into the fabric of Chicago. And all that divisive talk that happened for some, which is funny about the homeless shelters, because people kept saying back then, well, we need to take care of our own.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now we are. But people now, I was like, people don't like poor people. It was never about, let's have a homeless shelter for Native Chicagoans. People in neighborhoods don't want any kind of homeless shelter. And that was just subterfuge before to, you know, not like migrants.
Yeah. Well, I want to turn now to something that is, I would argue, personal to us. This is a WBEZ and somewhat former WBEZ panel. So I want to get your thoughts on the fact that President Trump has asked lawmakers to claw back more than $1 billion from public media. Lisa?
Yeah, so Congress introduced this rescission package. So it's formally been introduced now. It was sort of out in the vague, maybe it's going to happen. We all kind of knew it was coming. So they just kind of want to claw back all this money that's already been appropriated by Congress through, I think, 2027. And you know, Chicago Public Media, we get, I think we're funded at 6%.
6%.
6% of what we use here is funded by the federal government. We get some of that. And some of that's earmarked for certain things and whatever. It's not just like Susie's salary or, you know, whatever.
But, I wish, but no.
Right. So, but, you know, so we get a little bit. And while that's, what, a couple million dollars, something that is
that
going to make an impact, that will definitely make a difference in our service. But if you, I think the danger here is that you're looking at also tiny public radio stations in like Alaska that, you know, really, really like a majority of their funding comes from that. And I took a look really quick. I looked up KYUK in Alaska. It's on the western coast, kind of in the middle of the state, but on the coast. And it serves a 63,000 residents, 25,000, some very small population, really. And a lot of the listeners that they have are you know, indigenous peoples and speak different languages. And we're not going to speak in Inuit, you know, here in Chicago, but they have a very important service. So I'm concerned. I'm more worried about stations like these small stations that really, you know, that federal funding is crucial for them to provide basic information.
Emergency alerts.
Emergency information to the people who depend on them. You know, that's a bother.
Yeah, it's an interesting, I mean, this is not the first time that Republican administrations have tried to cut public media funding. I think it gets, the ideology gets confused, though, because a lot of times, and you see this with President Trump, who has really an axe to grind against media companies in general. You see suits against Paramount or other players. You see this playing out. To him, anything that's on the media, it should be about him. And if it's not pro him, it should be not on the radio or TV. And I think what's missing in the public radio and TV conversation is that news is a fraction of what public radio and public TV stations give. Children's programming comes into play, arts and culture. The reason public radio and public media was created in the first place is because they wanted a media agency that was not influenced by corporations and corporate money. And if I speak for someone who left the public radio system and now works in more commercial radio and media, they don't care about arts and culture. That's not something that moves the needle. They don't really care about bringing communities together or telling stories of people who don't usually are on the microphone. Those are things that don't make money. The things that make money are straight ahead, and I don't want to be so crass, but, you know, conflict. Conflict and dividing people makes money. That's what people click on all the time. You see this with Elon Musk and Donald Trump. Yeah. The number one story in probably the history of media is happening right now on everybody's analytics and everybody's websites if you're writing about Elon Musk and Donald Trump. The issue here is that part of it, and I thought that the government had foresight to think about this in the future, is at stake. And to me, that's important to point out that it's not just about news and about bias and whether or not you think it's the left of center or right of center. It's about the stories and the community, the arts, the food, the culture, the science, the everything that is going to change our society that we're talking about in this room today is public radio leans in where others may not. And I think that needs to be protected.
Yeah. Well, you know, Planned Parenthood, NPR, PBS, Corporation of Public Broadcasting, it's catnip for the right. And so I do think this administration just keeps pushing things to see how far they can go. I have thought at times, like, what is going to be the tipping point for the majority of Americans to push back on what's, I mean, there's so many things that are happening. We've discussed some of them.
Yes.
You know, is it going to be when eggs become $11? Is it going to be if, and again, these are like personal household things, they're not for the greater good. But I have wondered, is it going to be the decimation of Big Bird? Like, will that be this turning point when people are like, oh, wait, Sesame Street is on the chopping block? Hold up. Like, this is, now you've gone too far.
Right. I mean, you know, we'll be seeing it really soon, what that could be. We'll, of course, be keeping an eye on this story. You can read more about it at WBEZ.org. Just had to give that little plug.
Great site. Great. It's one of my favorite .orgs. Of all the .orgs out there, one of my favorites.
And we'll be cutting up parts of that conversation for the next pledge drive. Speaking of raising money, But this time for the city of Chicago, Mayor Johnson's team announced it's exploring a tax on groceries for city residents that could raise $80 million. Justin, give us the details.
Not even
this.
Close to enough to even approach what is going to be the deficit for the next budget for the city of Chicago. It's $1.12 billion. The COVID money's gone. Yep. The federal government has made it very clear in the first 6 months of this administration that they're not interested in funding anything that has anything to do with Chicago. So they're probably money there. So the mayor, rightfully so, is starting to have conversations about, which usually start in October. He's starting them now. And it's just to let people know there is going to be an array of taxes on services and in this case, the grocery tax. The grocery tax is interesting because the state had it what do you call it? Not rescinded, but it ends.
Yeah, so we still have that at the state level.
That was something that was put in place maybe during COVID. I'm not sure when it started, the grocery store tax. But a lot of municipalities have actually decided locally that they're going to continue the tax. So if you live in one of the suburbs or in a town in Illinois, you're getting a couple of cents extra on your tax from there. And Chicago and some of the alders, it was interesting, were kind of like annoyed that it wasn't in last year's budget, that we're already late to the game, that if 200 municipalities have already done that, why is that not on the books now? We could be gathering money now. I think it's a bigger picture. We are in a serious financial crunch. And it is going to be interesting how Mayor Johnson just figures out how to tax and do services and all the kind of things that align with his agenda, which is people first, and make sure that it's that sort of equity is at the heart of this. Because you could easily say property taxes and everybody more property taxes, you know, which I don't know if you could actually do any more property taxes than we have now. Right. You know, grocery store tax, Netflix, Uber. You saw it was interesting in Springfield. They pulled back on that transit. The transit plan, the reason they pulled back on that is because to fund that would have been more money in the tollways. They were talking about $2 extra on streaming services. They realized that was not going to look good and fly for Illinois taxpayers.
Right.
And so that's where they said, you know, well, right now is not the right time. That's essentially it. So the city's going to come in and say, should we put in $2 or $3 more dollars on Netflix? Should we be putting $2 or $3 more dollars on whatever services are provided?
It's exhausting.
It's and not to mention the I mean, think about the utilities. Here comes ComEd and people's gas
with
both
more money
hike.
For AI and you know this whole Meta agreement this week with
with so you're
the Clinton
have to balance
power
that.
Plant
and also be transparent. And I think the mayor has been transparent, saying this is where we're at. This is what the budget situation is. We have to decide what are services that need to be a part of Chicagoans' experience, and what needs to we're going to have to pay more for. It's not a great moment. In Chicago's history, to think of economic moment, because there's not a lot of places beyond saying, okay, let's borrow some money here and there that don't include taxing.
Yeah.
And so get ready.
Yeah. This is the weekly news recap.
Susie, my phone is blowing up. So everybody is, I think right now everyone's like, stop talking about taxes. Bumming me out on a nice Friday.
That is Justin Kaufman of Axios Chicago bumming you out on a Friday. Also with us, Northwestern University's Natalie Moore and WBEZ's midday news anchor Lisa Labez. I want to turn now to what has been maybe bothering your lungs for the past couple of days. It's very smoky and hazy in Chicago. It was worse yesterday, easing up a little bit today. Lisa, what is going on out there?
Yeah, today is an air pollution action day, much like yesterday, but it's just for, my air quotes, sensitive groups, says the website airnow.gov. And you can look at it. It's a pretty cool website. There's a nice interactive map. It shows you like what the air quality is in your neighborhood at any given time. And so, you know, if you are a person who has a heart condition or, you know, a lung issue, you know, probably don't stay outside and run a lot, or, you know, don't run your lawnmower. Don't contribute to the air pollution. You know, if you need to be outside, don't spend a ton of time outside. So, you know, just be careful.
Did any of you make any of these mistakes? Because I totally did.
I did.
My kids had track and field yesterday, and it was outside. And I also left the windows open overnight. So I
did that. I did that. But, you know, I don't think the air quality is as bad. I'm in the near suburbs, and I don't think it's quite as bad. It's hazy, but it's not. You know, and I went to an outdoor class last night, and I got there, and I was like, oh, look at that. It's canceled. So I showed up for nothing.
You know, second year in a row, right? I mean, the Canadian wildfires were last year, same time, June, July.
Was it was a little bit.
2 years ago.
I'm losing my mind now.
Yeah.
No, okay.
My daughter had field day in CPS yesterday, and she woke up and was like, I don't think I should participate. The air quality
is so mature.
I was like, it's up to you. You can, if you don't want to, you don't have to.
It is a moment. Right. I mean, I think the bigger picture too here is like, get ready. I mean, you're going to see more of these kind of instances when it comes to climate change and how it affects Chicago. I'm you know, last year we had the tornadoes that came through and actually landed in Chicago for the first time forever. So I think we have to be prepared. And you see it like even with the local news. It's funny watching ABC last night. They already have the graphics set up for what's red and yellow and green and blue. And that's something that was not something that Cheryl Scott was loading up in her CGI machine 5 years ago. So I think that it's the new normal that we're going to have a different impact
more and more.
Yeah, and then I'm told that, you know, you might not get symptoms right away, so like you might feel fine going on that run, but it might show up a day or two later.
Yeah, those like the particulates can get embedded in your lungs and they don't leave for a while.
And this is why I don't run.
I have noticed a lot more people outside wearing masks, you know.
Yeah.
And not just ICE agents. Well, just regular people riding their bikes or whatever, you know.
Yeah. Well, I want to end on
What's the next show? What's the next show?
We can keep hanging out.
Question here. I want to end on this question. So especially when we get the, like, you know, new census data, there's always this question about how much population Chicago is losing or retaining. And then, Justin, this week, you wrote about a new survey about this question. What was that? What were the findings?
It was a little bit complicated but it's essentially that Chicago, people who are here 10 or more years, love it. They're staying. There might be people leaving for political reasons, things like that. Where Chicago's having a problem is that we're losing more people who have only lived here under 10 years. So think about that. So you're talking about a lot of kids, right, who are going to come in here, come from college, they go to Chicago. I'm living in a big city. But when I, in 1993 or whatever, I had an apartment with a couple of roommates that my rent was $200. And, you know, that kind of thing, or my share at a different time. So I think what's happening is it's a study to show that it may not be, even though there are so many great opportunities for younger people in Chicago to come to Chicago and some of the amenities like public transit, affordable housing, just affordability in general are not what they used to be.
No.
And the city is not retaining those people as much as they have in the past. If you stay here more than a decade, it's a likelihood you're going to stay here forever.
Yeah.
And that's what this study points out, saying the percentages are starting to show that people who are younger are leaving.
Is it because you have the money to stay?
Or
if you've been
just at different times. Like I said, I mean, the job market's a great example too, where you're seeing a lot of less entry level opportunities here in anywhere in the country, but in Chicago particularly. So yeah, I think it has more to do with the opportunities that maybe we had when we were in 20s saying, I love this city, I'm going to stay here forever, as opposed to some who are like, you know what, this is more like New York and LA than it's ever been.
I would love to see a further breakdown of the demographics.
Yeah.
In education, in neighborhoods that survey pulled from.
Yeah.
Because there's so many different kinds of Chicagos.
Yeah. Let me see what I got here. Let me pull up the...
Well, we have just a minute left, so I just want to ask each of you very quickly. I feel like we're solidly Chicago people who are going to stay, but what would be the thing for you that you're like, all right, that this will get me to leave Chicago?
Nothing
from Natalie Morris.
That's a good one. I think that, you know, obviously climate's a good thing here for us as opposed to other places. But if that went south, that could be something to leave.
It's hard to, I mean, never say never, but I think probably people who are here 10 years or more, like they're anchored.
Yeah.
Like I'm not going to leave my parents. I'm not going to leave family. So that would make it, I don't know, like a... some sort of
maybe
multi-million dollar
job
where I could split my time between Chicago and other city.
Yeah. So basically, the answer is nothing.
Nothing. Yeah, pretty much. I think if I were to go anywhere else, it would be farther north.
Yeah.
Not south.
Oh.
All right. Well, we'll have to.
Bears leaving for Arlington Heights.
There you go.
I said it.
No, we'll have further to leave it there.
What about you, Susie?
Nothing. Nothing.
We're staying.
We've been speaking with Justin Kaufman, Natalie Moore, and Lisa Lavas. This was fun. Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that is it for Reset. I'm Susie Ahn. I'll talk to you on Monday.
I love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.